Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out. And when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish-resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Modelo is your reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome to this week's Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Today it is March 11. We are through the fourth weekend of college baseball, so we're humming right along in the season. And back again with me on the podcast today are Dave Serrano and Joe Healy. So welcome in, guys. Excited to talk about college baseball again this week.
Glad to be back and excited to talk about another good week in college baseball, Teddy.
Yeah, same. Thanks, Teddy.
So this weekend, we had a lot of interesting action around the country. The poll remains somewhat the same. You can check out the top 25 there at baseballamerica.com, and I would encourage you to do so. Vanderbilt remains number one this week. Number two, again, UCLA. Stanford is up to number three after a convincing series win against Texas. Florida State are up to 4-5. Oregon State, 6. Mississippi State, 7. North Carolina, one of your biggest losers of the week, down to 8 after getting swept at Clemson. And we have Texas Tech and Texas rounding out your top 10. Again, you can check out the rest of the rankings over at baseballamerica.com. I would also note that this week we have one new team in the top 25. That is Tennessee. The Vols are ranked for the first time since 2014. We will get into Tennessee a little more later, but they are off to a nice 15-1 start, though they lost on Sunday, dropping them from the ranks of the undefeated, which we are down to two undefeated teams in the country. They are North Carolina State and Arizona State. Both teams are at 15-0. And things are going to be tough this week for North Carolina State. So Arizona State is a little bit lighter slate. So if you're trying to make a pick as to which team remains undefeated the longest, Arizona State might be the way to go, with North Carolina State having Florida State on deck this weekend. But we'll get to all of that in a minute. I wanted to start here with Florida State and Mike Martin, who won his 2,000th career game. Yes, that is career win number 2,000 on Sunday, or on Saturday, the second game of a doubleheader on Saturday, and the finale against Virginia Tech, a series that Florida State won to open ACC play at 2-1. Mike Martin, of course, last year became the winningest coach in college baseball history, passing the great Augie Garrido, and now this year becomes the first coach in any college sport to reach 2,000 wins, which is just a remarkable number. This is his 40th and final season at Florida State. He is averaging just an incredible number of wins, obviously, and has won at least 40 games for the entirety of his career, never missed a regional. Just a a remarkable career that we've talked about a lot. But as he hits this milestone, this very significant milestone and the last milestone career milestone he will reach in terms of wins, it is worth going over just the remarkable accomplishment that is his career again. But Dave, you've competed against Mike Marin before. What stands out to you about him as a competitor?
Well, first and foremost, congratulations to Coach Martin, better known as 11 around the country. His teams were always well prepared. They had good players. They had some great players, but it was never always the best players in the country. But their teams knew how to win, and that probably has something to do with the tradition you talked about, the many years of winning. But the thing I walked away all the time competing against Coach Martin, and it wasn't a lot, was what a genuine, kind man he was. And, we could talk about the 2000 wins and still climbing, but it's the impact that I believe he's had on college baseball, he's had on the people around Florida State, the administration of Florida State, and the players and their families. And he's going to always be remembered for, I don't think anyone will ever break that record, and will coach long enough to surpass him and win in the amount of wins. But it's the people that he has touched throughout his life and had an impact on that I think is probably the biggest accolade that he can have. But that's the thing with me, is that he was just a genuine, he's a genuine man. And I have to stay partial in this, but I think a great ending to the story for college baseball in this 2019 season. And I know, Teddy, it's your preseason pick to win the national championship, but what would be anything and walk away as the winningest coach in all time and with the national hoisting the national championship trophy in his last season? You know, it's kind of like the Atlanta Braves through the years or the Buffalo Bills through the years in NFL football. People get criticized when they don't win the final game in the national championship or a championship. But I tell you what, looking back over Coach Martin's career, I don't know if one or two national championships would mean more than 40 years of unbelievable consistency of what he has shown for 39 years and now his 40th year. And, you know, they're off to a great start, and I think that 40-plus win is within reach again. But, again, I'm getting a little wordy on it, but what I'll remember Coach Martin about is a winner, but more importantly, a genuine man that has done so much for Florida State University and for that baseball program.
What's remarkable to me, I mean, there are many things that are remarkable to me about Mike Martin, but one of the most remarkable things to me is that there has been no let-up ever. They have always made a regional. They have always won 40 games, and it looks like they're well on their way to doing that again this season in his last year. And that is one of the things that sets him apart from his contemporaries and why he is the one to reach 2,000 wins, why Augie didn't do it, why some of these other guys didn't do it, because, you know, there are a lot of things that have worked in favor for Mike Marin over the years, starting with the fact that he's been the head coach at Florida State for 40 years. But the fact that there's never been any let-up is remarkable. Stanford under Mark Marques at the end, you know, they missed back-to-back NCAA tournaments before his final season when they were able to get back in. And, you know, Augie, as good as it was, the last 4 or 5 years there at Texas were not the same. They were under 500 at one point. And Mike Marin just hasn't had anything like that. Jim Morris, the last 2 years, Miami missed the tournament. And, you know, again, not only has it not happened at the end, it didn't happen in the middle. It's never happened at Florida State. And just that pure consistency is absolutely remarkable to me. And I have a piece coming about this at baseballamerica.com this week, just about how unbreakable this record may very well be. But if you look at there are 13 other active coaches who rank currently in the top 50 in career wins. None of them, due to age, is going to make up the gap between them and 2,000 career wins. The closest is Mike Fox, and he needs more than 550 wins. And that he has told me that's not going to happen. He's not shooting for that. But even if you look at some of the coaches that are kind of the next generation behind them, guys like Dan McDonald or Kevin O'Sullivan, those guys would have to average 40 wins for the next 33 years to reach 2,000 wins. That's basically Mike Martin's career that you're talking about. They've already accomplished so much. They've been head coaches for 10 years, and they still need 33 more years of 40 wins to get there. And that's just realistically not going to happen for those guys. And
Teddy, I'd like to add this too, and I should have said this earlier. The other thing that goes unnoticed is where he's located. They're in the state of Florida, and being one that's from the state of California, their midweek games are not easy wins all the time. When you're playing Central Florida and South Florida and Miami and Florida, those are tough games. And Florida State has always been in a good conference in the AC, now they're in the AC, they've been in the ACC. I mean, that's not easy to get to 40 wins every year. And I think that's something that probably goes unnoticed a little bit. It is not in a region of the country that you can get this pile of easy wins all the time. The other thing is the amount of times they've gone to the College World Series is that, and they've hosted a lot, and they're well-deserving of hosting a lot. But again, those 3 and 4 seeds that a lot of times get sent to their place are good teams that are usually from within their region of the country. So a lot of kudos goes to what he's done. And let's not forget, because I've been an assistant coach, and I've had great assistant coaches over my career as a head coach. Kudos to every assistant that's helped him along the way. And I know Coach Martin would be the first one to say that. This isn't all about Coach Martin. This is about the numerous of assistant coaches that he's had over his tenure that have helped him reach this milestone.
Joe, do you have, when we look around sports, it's hard to find anything that's analogous to Florida State's run at all. But do you have anything, does anything spring to mind to you that comes close to this kind of consistent success?
No, back to you guys. That's my honest answer, though, is because what you guys are describing is so unbelievable. And I was trying to do the same mental exercise you were doing, Teddy, where it's like, okay, let me map out the path for a coach to be able to get to 2,000 as well. And you can't really do it with any, realistically. And I guess the argument to that is, well, when Mike Martin started Florida State, you wouldn't have been able to map it out either. It turns out that he was that good at what he does. I don't know that I can come up with anything that's even in that realm. Part of it is because baseball is so unique in that you play so many games relative to even basketball. You're playing about twice as many games as college basketball teams do. And so it's just tough to come up with a comparison and to find anyone who could even come close to doing something like what he's accomplished. And you name the ones who are kind of in that neighborhood. I mean, I think Kevin Sullivan's probably the guy that most people would come up with as a guy who could get it done. And, it's just hard to put that level of success on anybody. And it's just kind of a testament to all that he's accomplished, of course.
I mean, you talk about how different baseball is just because it has so many more games. And what I was listening to the CBS College Basketball podcast last week, and they were talking about how, Carolina and Duke had, were meeting this weekend, and that they had two of the winningest programs ever. And they both have more than 2,000 wins. There are only 4 college basketball programs that have more than 2,000 wins. Like, I know it's a different sport and everything, but in their history, there are only 4 programs in the country in basketball that have more than 2,000 wins. Mike Martin has more wins than all but 4 college basketball programs, and obviously more than football because they only play 12 games and for the longest time didn't even play that many. So 2,000 is just such a big, big number, and he's just such a big, big part of Florida State, and it's going to be very strange next year when he's not in their dugout. They play on a field that has his name on it. He's been a part as a player or a head coach or an assistant coach of something like 2/3 of all of Florida State's program history. It's it's been a remarkable career. And Dave, like you said, I did pick them to win the national championship. I'm riding the sentimental streak a little bit when I do that, but I also think this team's really good. And you know, they got pressed by Virginia Tech this weekend. They needed a walk-off to win on Friday night in kind of crazy fashion. And then they got one hit in the first game of that doubleheader and then bounced back for a nice, solid series-clinching win. I think we're going to find out a little bit more about the Noles this week. They face a really tough week. They go to Florida on the midweek for the first of their rivalry games, and then they go up to North Carolina State on the weekend. And you know, this week could be a tough week for Florida State. I mean, it will be a tough week. We'll see how they handle it. And you know, this is a big test for a young team. You know, we've talked about Florida State before. There are a lot of freshmen, a lot of sophomores that they're relying on, and they're going to have to show that they've adjusted to their new roles or to college baseball, because this week it's going to come at them in a hurry, I think. Elsewhere in the ACC, we had Clemson sweeping North Carolina. That was a pretty surprising result. North Carolina had come into the year ranked in the top five as the ACC favorite and had done nothing to, you know, really dissuade us from thinking that to this point. They played really well through the first three weekends. Clemson, of course, coming off of a tough series loss against South Carolina in that rivalry series. And they really got it done this weekend against North Carolina. They had two walk-off wins and a blowout in the middle to sweep that series. And, you know, it was a kind of a weird series. The first game of Saturday, the first game got postponed due to rain, so they played a doubleheader on Saturday. And in the first game, North Carolina goes into the ninth leading by one run, and that turns into a loss on a balk. Just a strange play all the way around there to secure a win for Clemson. And then Clemson really blew up Tyler Baum, who to this point had been maybe the best of North Carolina's three really good starters. And then on Sunday in the finale, North Carolina again holding a one-run lead going into the ninth inning. And again, Clemson finds a way, this time down to its last strike. Logan Davidson hit a bomb to right field to finish off the sweep. Pretty remarkable weekend, pretty remarkable turnaround for Clemson. They really needed that, because if they'd compounded the series loss against South Carolina with one against North Carolina, then you're starting to dig yourself a bit of a hole. And they went out and made sure that did not happen. But from a North Carolina perspective, Joe, what does this weekend mean for the Tar Heels?
Well, it's tough, and I think it's tougher for them probably emotionally, just getting over that and the possible hangover from that, than it really is in the win-loss column. Because as you described, the losses were just kind of gutting, and in their own different ways, frankly. I mean, in that first game of the doubleheader, it was a walk-off balk, but they also had, you know, Keir Meredith of Clemson had an RBI hit that was just kind of a little dribble up the middle through a shift that just kind of found its way to the outfield, that if it's a few feet either direction, that's an out, and the rally probably never even gets that far. So that's, and then of course you lose it on a balk. That's a tough way to lose, and you get blown out, and that's tough in a different way. They really never were in that second game. And then the third game, I mean, they got two outs in that ninth inning just like that, and they were one out away, and then you have a double and a home run, boom, boom, and suddenly the game's over. And that's just kind of a jarring thing that, you know, 5 minutes earlier they probably thought they were going to wrap up a win and kind of salvage a game, which is a big deal on the road in ACC play. Now, the good news with that is they've got a five-game week coming up, which isn't always a great thing because those are just exhausting weeks, I can imagine. But, you know, they're going to be able to get back on the field here pretty quickly. They've got midweeks with Gardner-Webb and UNC Wilmington. So they will get a chance to kind of get back on the metaphorical horse there, which I think is probably going to be helpful. And they've got Miami coming up, and that's where it's, you know, something where it's important that they do get back on the horse mentally and kind of get back to winning, because Miami's has proven to be a tough customer. So that's not going to be an easy one, even home. In the win-loss column, I don't know that it's really all that damaging. I mean, wins in March count just as much as wins in May. But at least now, I mean, by the time we get to May, if North Carolina is North Carolina and does what we expect them to do in ACC play, this series sweep is going to be a big feather in Clemson's cap. But I think we will have largely kind of forgotten about it with North Carolina, as long as their record and their profile ends up looking like we think it will. So I think it's more just kind of an immediate emotional thing to overcome versus any sort of hole they're in from a win-loss standpoint. Where it could end up mattering, if we really want to kind of get into the weeds with this, is, you know, when you're splitting hairs at the end of the year and looking at resumes and looking at teams that are going to be top eights or hosts, it really does get down to splitting hairs, and this was an opportunity for North Carolina to get some quality road wins. I mean, I think Clemson's probably going to be a top 25 RPI team, certainly a top 50 RPI team, and that's an opportunity to get road wins against a quality opponent, and the RPI, of course, gives you a bonus for road wins, and it looks good in your nitty-gritty report that you have the top 25 wins. And this was an opportunity to at least grab one of those, and that's an opportunity by the wayside. And you only get, even in a quality league like the ACC, you only get so many of those opportunities. So again, that's a really minor thing, but something that can end up coming back up. But in the grand scheme of things, like I said, if North Carolina is what we think they will be, I think this will kind of be ancient history by the time May rolls around, but certainly a tough thing for them to swallow.
Yeah, I think it's fortunate for them that they're in the division that they're in. This is always fortunate for them in baseball right now, but the A's is the harder division of the two. And you know, so North Carolina, with that 0-3 record, it is bad in terms of just trying to win their division, which is helpful in terms of building resumes as well. But you know, they are in a division where they should be able to bounce back from that, but they're going to have to get back to it pretty quickly here. Because that Miami team coming in is improved. They're sitting at 12-3 and coming off a nice series win against Tech. So it's going to be important for North Carolina. Like Clemson didn't let that South Carolina series loss, North Carolina also has to quickly get back to it, like you said there, Joe. Dave, have you ever seen a walk-off balk?
Oh, I've seen many of them for my team I've been part of, and I've also seen them against the team I've been coaching in. And it's an exciting part of baseball, obviously. It is. And I saw the videotape of Logan Davidson and in that atmosphere, and it had to be really exciting, especially with those two heralded programs going toe-to-toe and with Clemson having the sweep on the line to sweep a great North Carolina team. I'm sure the atmosphere is unbelievable. But, yeah, I've been part of the walk-off bombs for the good and also for the bad, too.
What about a balk? Because that one feels a little rarer. Lonnie Lee told me he'd never seen a walk-off balk before.
I misunderstood you. The balk, I have never been part of one, but I've actually sat in and saw one. It was the year I left Cal State Fullerton to take the Irvine job, and we qualified for the regionals in 2005. So I was in attendance for the Fullerton-Arizona State Regional at Fullerton. And actually it was the Super Regional. And in game one, there was a balk call, and I know the umpire well. He's out of Tennessee, but I won't mention his name. Called the balk on the Arizona State pitcher to leave Arizona State on the field and give Fullerton game one of the Super Regional. And credit to Coach Murphy, who was coaching Arizona State at the time, he could have really have lost it, because it's a tough way to lose a game at any time, but it's even more expensive when you're in a super regional and you lose game one. They came back and beat Fullerton the next two games to go to their first World Series in a long time. We had matched up a lot with Arizona State in regionals and super regionals, and we had been lucky enough to beat them quite a few times and knock them out. But I gave a lot of credit to Coach Murphy, because he could have really lost the school, but I think he played it in reverse, and he really played a psychological game on his team, and mentally they came back stronger than ever to win the series. But that was just as a fan sitting in the stands, Teddy, that was tough to take. Even though, obviously, I was partial to Cal State Fullerton, because I had known a lot of those players, had recruited them, had been in the dugout with Coach Vanderhoof and Coach Horton, it was tough to see anybody losing that. And when Joe was talking about that, about the balk and all that, how North Carolina lost, right away my mind went to that game, because that's a tough way to lose a game. I, fortunately, have never been part of one, for the good or the bad, but that's a heartbreaker to lose a game that way.
Yeah, if you watch the video of the way that game ended against Carolina, you know, Clemson for a second doesn't actually know what's going on. It takes the umpire. So the balk play was Joey Lancelotti faked a pickoff to third base with a runner at third base, and you're no longer allowed to do that. That was outlawed this year. And so it takes everyone a second to realize, like, oh, that happened, and oh, he's not allowed to do that. And then the umpires, you know, make the call, and the runner on third, you know, jogs home, and Clemson starts celebrating. But it was, you know, if you contrast that to the video of Logan Davidson's home run on Sunday to win the game, you know, everyone knows from the second Davidson hits the ball, it's gone, and, you know, can start the celebrations. It's just a very strange scene, and Monty Lee told me it was kind of an enigmatic way to win a game, because at first he wasn't even sure that they were going to call it, and they really had no choice. But, you know, that's just such a strange way to end a game. But speaking of Logan Davidson, Dave, I know you got a chance to talk with him last week for a story that we'll have soon in Baseball America, and he seems to start to come around. His batting average popped up like 30-35 points this weekend. He has that huge home run on Sunday. Just what do you feel like he's starting to heat up?
Well, I do, and you know, it was a pleasure talking to him. Well, what an unbelievable young man he is, and it just goes to show why, of all the accolades that he'll continue to get throughout the year, and why Clemson's leaning on him so much to help take them where they want to go. But the thing that made me feel really confident that he was going to, and you, even in the South Carolina series, he had a horrible series. You could start to see that the bat was coming along a little bit. I thought he pressed a little bit in some at-bats, and he was, you know, he talked to me a lot about how he was being pitched differently this year, kind of like Seth Beer was the year before. And he wasn't comparing himself to Seth Beer, but he was saying how he's kind of the guy that they're pitching around. He wasn't seeing many fastballs anymore. He was having to adjust his approach to seeing more off-speed pitches and not missing his fastball when he got. But Teddy, the part to me that just knocked me off my socks is, you know, we both emphasized it was a small sample size. We had talked about the slow start, and I'll be honest with you, I think the slow start was probably more from the people that were sitting in the stands, the fans, the scouting industry, professional people that are wanting to see this guy as a top pick in the country and want to see him come out of the gate quickly. Well, it was 12 games, and that's why you just made a great comment. His average just went up 30 points this weekend. That just goes to show how small the sample size it was after 12 games. But his comment to me was he's not worried about his average because there are so many other ways he can help his team. He could help his team defensively, and that was the first thing that I always look at is when a guy struggles offensively, does he take it to defense? Well, he wasn't. He knew that if he wasn't being the guy that they needed, that he can be the best guy that they can be at the shortstop position defensively. He talked about base stealing. When he did get on base with a walk or somehow getting on base, how he could keep stealing bases, which was going to help his team win. And then the thing was that he said no matter what kind of start he was getting off to, he was just going to continue to be the best teammate and the best team leader that he can be for Clemson baseball. And he reiterated to me that he wasn't hearing the outside chatter. He says, that's what we do at Clemson. We don't listen to the outside chatter. It's just about us. And after that conversation with him and how much he talked about his family and his relationship with his father, Mark, and all that stuff, it just proved to me that this guy was going to break out of a slump. I didn't know it was going to be this weekend, but how he was going to get, and he did have a good weekend besides the walk-off home run, that this guy had his head on right, and he had his tunnel vision of what direction he was going, and he was going to get it turned around. And as you'll see in my piece, Clemson had gotten off to a good start. Now they're off to a really good start at 12-3. Is when he got hot, what were they going to be able to do then? And it kind of goes to show that with the sweep of North Carolina this weekend.
Absolutely. And I think that one thing I should have mentioned about Clemson earlier is that their pitching this weekend was a lot better in terms of the starters. They shuffled their rotation, and a week ago they didn't get anyone pitching past the fourth inning among the starters, and this week everyone pitched into the sixth. And so if they get that starting pitching figured out, and you know, I think this new look rotation has a chance to have that figured out, and they get Logan Davidson going, that team sounds like the scary team that we kind of expected they would be coming into the season. Out west, Stanford and Texas had a top 10 showdown this weekend. We've talked about Stanford and Texas a fair amount before. They're two of the better teams coming out of the gate this season. And so that was going to be a fun series. And Texas took the first game on Thursday night. It was a four-game deal Thursday to Sunday. And Texas started with a win, and then Stanford responded by really blowing the doors off the Horns the next 3 days there on the farm. And I continue to be very, very impressed with what the Cardinal have done this season. I know that there were some questions about what they would do on the mound, given who that they lost last year in Tristan Beck and Chris Bubich. But that offense really seems like it's heating up. They beat a good Texas pitching staff pretty good those last three games. And, you know, now as Stanford goes into its finals break, they're rolling. They're the number one team in the country. And I think that the first month of the season has been very, you know, they've been one of the most impressive teams to start the year. As they go into their break now, I mean, just what do you guys make of the Cardinal? And, I'm personally not concerned about this from Texas' standpoint. They went and won one game. If it's a three-game series, I don't think anyone would be looking at it that funny. It's just kind of they go 1-3 out at Stanford, and it is a little tougher. But what are your thoughts coming out of this series, Joe?
Yeah, just really impressed with Stanford. And I think what's kind of scary about for other teams with what Stanford has done is it really doesn't necessarily feel like we've gotten the best version of Stanford just yet. The offense is heating up, but they're still waiting on some guys. Andrew Dashback is hitting just above 200, for example. Tim Tawa, veteran, hitting under 200. So, and they've had some guys in and out of the lineup as well. So it feels like for all the success they've had, and it has been significant, obviously, and the good performances they've gotten, on the pitching side in particular, Eric Miller's been really good. Brendan Beck has been really good. Guys like that. That maybe there's still another gear in there. And that has to be scary for everyone else, particularly in the Pac-12, because this team has already accomplished a lot, and it feels like we haven't seen quite their best yet. It is good news for the Pac-12. You know, there's been a lot of hand-wringing about the Pac-12 in recent years, and UCLA and Stanford have done a lot of heavy lifting for that league, but I don't think it's pretty inarguable at this point that the Pac-12 looks improved this season. We talked about Arizona State, and we've talked about UCLA in the past, now about Stanford. But it's really important that they have a couple of teams that are really kind of carrying the flag as we get closer and closer to the postseason. And Stanford certainly looks like they are going to be one of those teams.
I think Stanford is for real. I agree with you, Teddy. I don't think this is anything to panic about for Texas. They go across the country. They play a top five team, and yeah, they didn't fare well in the last three games. So I wouldn't panic on Texas as of yet. I think if you're Dave Esker at Stanford, your biggest concern is what you said at the gate. They go into their break. I think they're in finals now for one of their quarters. That would, as a coach, as a former coach, that would be a concern of mine, because they're playing good baseball and they're starting to climb a little bit. And now with that break, I think that would concern me a little bit going into that. Is will that time off and the focus going to the high academics at Stanford and getting through those exams, is that going to disrupt, I'm used to it at Stanford. That's something that goes on there. A lot of times the last quarter ends up when they're in the Super Regionals going into Omaha. So they're used to that. But that would be a little bit of a concern. But, boy, they're a good baseball team. And I agree with Joe that really with them and UCLA and ASU and even Oregon that's having a good year and other teams in that league, I think the Pac-12 is back this year. And I think we should expect some good in Oregon State. We should expect some good things out of that league.
Absolutely, and I think that's a good point about both the concerns about Stanford taking this next week or so off, but also they are used to it there. So if anyone can handle the kind of momentum change that could potentially happen, it would be them. I think they have kind of a soft opening into Pac-12 play the following week. Which is good for them as they look to get back into it. But, I think that team, I have just been very, very impressed with them, and it's going to be an interesting race out in the Pac-12 this year. Right now, it looks like kind of a three-team race between Stanford, UCLA, and Oregon State, and UCLA and Oregon State playing each other this weekend. So we'll see what comes of that. But I think that, those three teams pick the class of the conference, but I think there is more. There is more depth beyond just those elite teams. But when you have those elite teams, people are going to perceive your conference a little bit differently, because they have three teams right now that are, Omaha contenders, pretty firmly Omaha contenders. We mentioned at the top that Tennessee came into the rankings at number 25. Tennessee sitting at 15-1. They've been pretty coming out of the gate. You know, starting 15-0, the best start in program history, I believe. And you know, then they do lose that finale against Fresno State, but still a very strong start. Dave, I know you've been able to see some of that series this weekend. Just what are your thoughts on Tennessee going into SEC play?
Well, I think they really got tested this weekend with what I think is going to end up being a solid Fresno State team. I had a chance to talk to Coach Batesall before the game and before the series, and he really likes this team. Felt that they haven't hit stride yet. They've been playing in bad weather like many teams around the country. He really likes it's an older group. He feels they're going to be offensive. And I think that kind of showed a little bit this weekend. I think Tennessee was finally tested from the other side offensively. I thought Fresno had a good approach. I'm concerned if you're Coach Anderson, who works with the pitchers at Tennessee, is I think the walks went up a little bit more this weekend. And is that due to the fact that Fresno had a little more way offensively? Garrett Allings had another good start on Friday for the Vols, but he got hit around a little bit, gave us some hits. And that's a little bit of kind of been his MO a little bit, because he's such a strike thrower and doesn't have unbelievable stuff, but he has good stuff. Zach Lingenfelter had a very good start in Saturday's game. It was a game that was throughout the whole game. There was a steady drizzle. It became a little bit heavier as the game went on. Tennessee kind of jumped out to an 11-0 lead. And like most coaches do, Coach Vitella started putting in some other guys, making some changes. And next thing you know, it's 11-8 in the eighth inning. And Fresno has two guys on, and the umpires stopped the game. And I know there was a bone of contention for Coach Baseball on that. It's been raining all game. Why are you stopping it now? They end up stopping it. Tennessee comes back in the first game Sunday. They're suspended and comes out with Garrett Crochet. He ends up stopping that rally, and then it went 13-9. And then the following game, which was game three, I just saw Fresno come out and just attack Will Neely. He was a little bit more elevated than I'm used to seeing Will Neely. They had some good approaches to it. It was a back-and-forth game. Fresno jumps out for nothing lead, and then Tennessee comes on back to take a 5-4 lead, and then Fresno goes ahead and scores a bunch of unanswered runs to end up winning 10-7. But I think it was a good test for Tennessee going in. They're a good team. I don't think this is any panic button. We all knew that every team that's undefeated will eventually in the game of baseball is going to lose a game. And it's how they handle this now. They go to Auburn, and notoriously the Tennessee program over the years has not handled playing on the plains very well. So I think this is a big weekend. They go into a place that has Auburn has very good pitching. Their first two starting pitchers are putting up great numbers. But I really, truly, like I've said all year long, I think this is the most suited team going into SEC play than Tennessee's had in many years. And I think more about this team this weekend, and now they'll go back to the drawing board and fix some things as they head into SEC play next weekend.
I think Tennessee kind of transitions very nicely into the next subject we wanted to touch on, which is as the ACC and some other conferences got going this last weekend, but most conferences start conference play this weekend. And, I think Tennessee qualifies a little bit as one of the biggest surprises of the season. I know a lot of people thought they'd be improved, but 15-1 is a little more improved than at least I thought they would be. But, Joe, why don't you tell us about a team that has surprised you so far this year?
So we're going to talk about the U. A very on-the-radar team, not typically where I go with this, but I have been surprised with them, specifically the way they've been able to step forward offensively. I tend to be sometimes a little bit of a skeptic when you have a team that struggles on one side of the ball, returns a lot of that same core the next year, and then the expectation is that they're just going to improve across the board. While that can be the case, sometimes I'm a little bit dubious of whether or not that should just be expected. Because a lot would have had to happen for that to be the case. And that's the way I feel about Miami's offense. They've just struggled so much on that ball the last couple of years, and they returned this year a lot of that same core. And so I was just maybe having a hard time fully coming around to the fact that, look, every one of these guys is going to have to be significantly better, or at least good enough this time around for them to be better as a team overall. And that's absolutely what's happened so far. They're hitting over 300 as a team, better than 400 on base percentage. you know, Freddy Zamora has really become a big guy on the, in this offense, leading the way, hitting over 400, had a walk-off home run against Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech was this close to winning that series. You know, in the Saturday game, they had a lead going into the bottom of the ninth inning, and Freddy Zamora hits a walk-off home run to left field. But, you know, he's having a nice year. Raymond Gill having a nice year. Of course, Alex Terrell, 8 home runs already on the year. But you really just go up and down the lineup, and everybody's back. Like, what people said would have to be the case for them to improve, and there was an assumption that would be the case. That's absolutely happened. And so, you know, I was kind of wrong on them, thinking that maybe, yes, I thought some of these guys would improve and they would show some improvement on the offensive side of the ball, but I didn't really necessarily expect this. They're sitting at 12-3 overall. Obviously, two of those losses were in the series to Florida, but I don't even really think of that as a negative on their resume. We talked about it a little bit with the opportunity Carolina had earlier. Miami took advantage of that to a certain degree. I mean, they were disappointed to lose that series, but they did come up with at least one win in that series, which is going to show nice as a road high RPI win come the end of the season. So as long as they take care of the business otherwise, I think that's going to end up being as much of a neutral thing as much as a positive or negative on their resume. So you knew the pitching was going to be there, and it absolutely has. Evan McKendry's been very good. Chris McMahon has been good and showing electric stuff. Brian Van Bell is kind of a nice, more of a good college they have going on Sundays. So, you know, not to mention some of the new Slade Ciccone, for example, one of the new faces for them. So you felt pretty good about that, had questions about the offense, and they've just answered every one of those questions I think we could have possibly had about them.
Yeah, I mean, that team is going to be tested this weekend, but I thought that they passed a pretty good test this week, beating a good Georgia Tech team and starting ACC play at 2-1. That was an important series for them to win, being at home and gain conference play off to a good start. So it'll be interesting to see how the Canes continue to develop this season. They're still a pretty young team. You know, we talk about Arizona State and some of these other teams that last year were super young teams. Well, Miami was rather young last year too. And you know, I think that, you know, having those kids be a year older and a year better, stronger is going to pay dividends for them. It certainly has so far. Dave, how about you? Who's impressed you the most so far?
I don't know if I want to say impressed. I'd say a team that and a program that's on a rebound, and that would be Penn State. I think Rob Cooper and his coaching staff have done a great job. You're talking about, I talk about small sample sizes. They've played 12 games, and they've won 60% of the amount of games they won last year in a 49-game slate. They were 15-34 in 2018, and they're already 9-3, and they've done it all on the road. They were down in Florida, which seemed like for 2 weeks down there playing teams. They've been in Cary. They've been all over the place, and they haven't been at home yet. And, again, it's the start of the season. It's 12 games in. They've been no-hitted already this year. But I think it's a big turnaround for Penn State. They're only hitting .238 as a team, but it's been about their clutch hitting. They've gotten their offensive guys have been DeVore Sox, Chris Clemmer, and a name I love, Gavin Homer. Those have been the three guys that have been the big run producers and have been pounding the numbers for them, but they're only hitting .238 as a team, which just goes to show they're getting timely hitting when they need to. They go down to Central Florida and win the series against a good Central Florida team on their field, which goes to show me that they are trending in the right direction. I think where the biggest change has been for them is their pitching staff. Last year they pitched in the mid-5 ERAs. Now they're down in 39. I think Josh Newman has done a good job with that pitching staff, and they're going to continue to need to get that because I don't know if they're going to have the offense that's going to be able to be the juggernaut that's going to, when they get to the Big Ten, on carrying them to victory. They're going to need to continue to play good defense and continue to pitch, but very happy for them. Rob Cooper's a good coach that has struggled there. They're off to a good start, and, you know, we talked about this a lot. Confidence really can kill plays. I think we see that with Tennessee, and I think we're kind of seeing that with Penn State too. They've got a tough road ahead of them still, but they're off to a good start, and they're going in the right direction.
Yeah, it certainly is a bigger from a year ago and, frankly, from the last several years. So I'm very interested to see what the Nittany Lions have in store once they get into Big Ten play, which is still a couple weeks away up north. I wanted to mention Santa Barbara. I think UCSB has started the season, you know, very, very well. They're off to an 11-2 start. They're coming off of a sweep at Tulane, and they really hit very well this weekend. They came out and they scored 31 runs on the road. And I think that, you know, this is a team that has some offensive potential and, has had it for a couple of years, but it seems like they're tapping into that a little better right now. But I think especially they're getting to their potential on the mound. And I've been waiting for some of these kids who came in as pretty prominent recruits to kind of figure it out and get it rolling for the last couple of years. And it seems like that's happening now. I'm talking about especially guys like Ben Brecht and Jack Dashwood, who have very good in starting roles for the Gauchos so far. Ben Brecht has 32 strikeouts, 5 walks, and 22 innings. The whole UCSB pitching staff is pitching like that. As a team, they're averaging 10.64 K per 9, which is very impressive. And they have some nice arms in the bullpen. Chris Lincoln is really good coming out of the bullpen. And Chris Troy, I know, is a guy that is very exciting as well as a converted catcher. And, both of those guys have some power arms back there. And so I think if UCSB can continue this offensive surge, I think the pitching is showing right now that it's definitely going to, that they've figured it out, that those kids are ready to go now. And so if this offensive surge continues for UCSB, I think that that's, a team that can really play at a high level in the Big West. And we're only a couple weeks away from the start of Big West play, and they're going to start it against Fullerton on the road. So we're going to find out pretty quickly how they fare in the Big West. But, when you look at the Big West, obviously we've had Irvine ranked all year, and I think that we all think that Fullerton is a pretty solid team that, going to continue the line of powerful teams there at Fullerton. I think UCSB can get in the mix there, and if the Big West can have a team like that jump in, that'd be big because, the last couple of years it hasn't been quite as good at the top. It's been more of a one or two horse race sometimes, and maybe this year there can be a little more depth at the top of that conference, which is always solid top to bottom. But if you have teams like Santa Barbara and Fullerton all operating at a high level, that should make for a pretty fun spring out in the Big West. So now, guys, I want to move on to our shout outs. So who do you want to shout out this week, Joe?
So a couple things. One is a shout out to what I always describe as homecoming week here in the Midwest, because it feels like teams are finally starting to make their way back home. There's some hardy souls who have tried to play early in the year. Shout out head coach Andy Sawyers in Southeast Missouri State, who played a home series over opening weekend. Had to shovel snow to get it done, but I have a lot of respect for that. They're like, no, we're playing at home this weekend, and we're going to shovel snow to get it done. So I appreciate that. But we're getting to the point where a lot of teams up around are starting to come back. A lot of them have their first home series weekend, with many of them starting or having at least one tune-up weekend before they get into conference play. Some teams have tried to do it a little bit earlier this year and have gotten burned. Famously, Nebraska was going to be playing Baylor at home this past weekend, and it ended up getting moved to Baylor, which I guess from a postseason standpoint works out better for them because now they have a nice road series win, so there's that. But so that's always a big deal up here. It's kind of nice to have more going on in the Midwest and Northeast now that the weather's just slightly warmer in general, but slightly warmer. My other shout-out is William & Mary, out of the Colonial, a team that won all of 3 conference games last year. We'll remains to be seen how many they win in conference because they haven't started yet, but they won just 15 all last year, 15-39. They are 12-1 this year. And there's some quality wins on their resume there too. I mean, they have a win over Virginia. They just finished sweeping Campbell, a team that we think is pretty talented and could be a player in the Big South. So a quick start for them. And this is a program I think that is probably better than most people recognize. Now they're obviously in the Colonial where all that ends up kind of mattering is the conference tournament, unless it's one of the years when, for instance, UNC Wilmington is pretty good and gets into at-large contention. But for the most part, this is a one-bid league, and so it comes down to how well you play that week in May. They've won 30 or more games in 5 of the last 7 seasons. They were in a regional as recently as 2015, and they'd won a couple years before that, I believe. So really just kind of a quietly consistent program in the Colonial, off to a really good start this year. And looks much improved over last year, at least as far as the records go. So I'll be interested to watch them continue throughout the rest of the season.
Hey, the Colonial was a two-bid league, last year, Joe. So you got to watch out for them. Dave, who do you got?
Well, I want to give a shout out to Texas Tech's offense this past weekend against Wichita State in sweep. They only hit 551 with runners in scoring position, which would equal success. That's an unbelievable number. Obviously, we talked early in the year about the offense. Our question was their pitching staff. Their offense is obviously clicking on all. That's an amazing number right there to hit over 550 for the weekend with runners in scoring position. As I like to do with the coaching shout-outs, we've talked a lot about Coach Morton. I want to say that again. Congratulations to 11 on win number 2,000. That's an unbelievable number to say. But then also Ed Blankmeyer at St. John's winning number 800 during the midweek out in California against the University of San Diego. And Tim Corbin this weekend winning number 800 at Vanderbilt. And just to go to show for the listeners how unbelievable Coach Martin's number of 2,000 is, you're talking about Tim Corbin and Ed Blankmeyer, two wonderful, great coaches that have coached for a long time, are still 400 wins short combined to Coach Martin. That just goes to show what he's accomplished.
Absolutely. And I want to add one more member to the 800 win club. I guess it was win your 800th game week in college baseball, because Rich Maloney of Ball State, my alma mater, hit number 800 this weekend as well. And those three guys, have incredible careers. And yes, they're 1,200 wins behind where Mike Martin is. But congrats to Coach Blankmeyer and Coach Corbin as well. I wanted to mention.
I will cut in here real quick, Teddy. I was wildly disrespectful to the Colonial. I have gone back and looked now. They've been a two-bid league three of the last 4 years. Obviously, last year it was Northeastern, kind of upsetting the order there and getting postseason with a good year. But yeah, three of the last years, Colonial, a two-bid league. So my sincere apologies. I mean, I it comes off a little snarky, but sincere apologies. I guess I just kind of overlooked that. But between College of Charleston and UNC Wilmington being inconsistent, and Delaware got in 1 year. So two-bid league more often than not of late. So my apologies to the Colonial.
You can build some pretty nice resumes in the Colonial. We'll see if William & Mary can do it this year. Also wanted to mention Bryant, which is off to a solid start. They have now won back-to-back series against Virginia Tech, and then this weekend, Elon. They beat Kyle Brnovich in the first game, and then George Kirby. Also, shout-out George Kirby, who threw a one-hitter against Bryant. And then Bryant... So Bryant and Elon playing a doubleheader on Sunday because of some rain. Bryant wins in 16 innings, 6-5, to win a very hard-earned series win at Elon, having to beat a preseason in Kyle Brnovich and then a 16-inning marathon at the back end of a doubleheader on the road. So the Bulldogs, since they've got swept at LSU, no shame in that, have really been on a solid here. And this team, I don't think, is going to put together the kind of resume that they did 3 years ago in 2016 when they wound up being a two seed. But I do think that this is a team that, has some firepower. And, we'll see if they can get themselves into at-large territory if they need. But if they are able to get into regionals, whether it's an at-large or winning the NEC tournament, that's going to be a team that I don't think a lot of other teams are going to want to see show up in their brackets. So I think Bryant, team to watch up in the Northeast this season. So I think that kind of rounds up week four of college baseball. Week five is going to be absolutely amazing, hopefully. We mentioned that conferences are starting to get going this week throughout much of the country, and the Big 12, Pac-12, and SEC all start conference play with a top 10 series. So those should be pretty fun as conference play gets going. And so we're going to have a lot to talk about next week on the Baseball America College podcast. So make sure you're subscribed to it so it just pops into your favorite podcasting app. And if you can, rate us and leave us a review, that helps other people find the podcast and let us know what you think of it. So if you can take a few moments to do that, we would really appreciate it, especially if that's you tapping on the five stars. Until then, till next week, when we'll be back with that and a new Top 25, make sure to check out all of the content over at baseballamerica.com. It's not just college content. There's also plenty of pro coverage. And this week, Ben Badler's international reviews, which are absolutely invaluable. They are beginning to roll out team by team. He breaks down who all 30 clubs have signed in the international market over the last year. So stuff you can't get anywhere else. So make sure to check that out over at baseballamerica.com. And to follow us on Twitter, I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is Joe_on_sports. And Dave is at Dave Serrano 11. So we'll be back here next week to talk about an exciting start to conference play throughout the country. And hopefully you will join us then. So thank you for listening.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.